This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is Joy 94.9's Family Matters podcast, your light-hearted look at parenthood and rainbow families, sponsored by Berry Street. Did you know that Berry Street seeks members of our LGBTI communities to become foster carers? Not only do they have a proud tradition of training and embracing LGBTIQ carers, they officially support marriage equality. Learn more now at berrystreet.org.au, a proud Joy sponsor for over 5 years.
This is the Dying to Know podcast series.
On this podcast, you're going to hear Molly Carlisle, also known as the Death Talker.
If you're dying to know, we're dying to tell.
Molly Carlisle has an extensive clinical background in specialist palliative care nursing, counselling and education. As a leader in her field, Molly has held a variety of regional, state and national positions in the healthcare sector. She is a member of the Order of Australia and the recipient of many other awards, including the Minister's Award for Outstanding Achievement by an individual or team in healthcare. She is a Churchill Fellow and a National Ambassador for Dying to Know Day. Welcome, Molly.
Thanks, Stephanie. It's lovely to be here.
Yeah, and thank you for joining us on Joy 94.9. Molly, let's begin with Dying to Know Day. When did you first become involved and why do you think it's an important initiative?
So the Groundswell Project established Dying to Know Day in 2013, and it grew out of the people who established the Groundswell Project were arts and health people. I was in the arts and health sort of space, and they were looking at how we could better get communities talking about death and dying and grief, and they approached me and said, would you be an ambassador? And of course I jumped at it because I think that's really important too. So I've been involved since the very first year.
And what are some of the events that you've attended over the years?
Well, the first year, at the time I was working at Austin Health at the Olivia Newton-John Cancer Centre, and I actually am really lucky because Olivia's a really good friend of mine now, and we talk to each other regularly and email regularly, and anyone who's read my last book would see that Olivia wrote the foreword because she really gets it. But at the time, she was very focused on the cure for cancer sort of pathway. And when I started talking to her about, you know, sometimes people don't get better and it's not their fault and it's not because they didn't try hard enough or anything else. It's just because the illness is the illness and sometimes you don't get better. She really grabbed onto that and ran with it. So the first year we did a huge event at the cancer centre that was, we set up a lounge room in the foyer of the cancer centre. We built this huge fireplace and we had an armchair and a lamp and a rug, and we invited people to come in and talk about the things that were important to them in their lives and about death. And we thought we'd get probably, I don't know, 10 or 11 people to come and sit in the chair and talk. And we had, you know, a film crew and stuff there. Well, we thought we'd go for 2 hours. We went for four, and there were people queuing up to sit in the chair and talk. And there was a huge, like, the audience just grew because everyone was really enthralled with the stories people told. And to me, that said, you know what? Even these people who are here having cancer treatment, who are hoping they're going to get better, want to talk about this stuff. So it really reinforced the message for me that it doesn't matter what station you have in life, what cultural background you come from, you know, what your family situation is, what your socioeconomic situation is, death is the thing that we all have to face one day, and everyone thinks about it, but no one talks about it. And that's what Dying to Know Day is all about, just giving people a platform or an avenue to talk about the things that they're too scared to talk about in their own, you know, private circle.
So, Molly, if it is as simple as providing a forum for people, what are some of the forums that the organisation are providing around the event on the 8th of August?
So, look, there's people doing all sorts of things, and I don't work at the Austin anymore. I'm now CEO at Southeast Palliative Care, and our team did their first ever Dying to Know Day last year, and we put a big, huge bucket up out the front of, like a cut-out bucket out the front of the office, and we asked people to write down the things that were important to them and stick them in the bucket. This year, our staff, and I've stepped right back from it this year. I've let the staff, well, I haven't let them. I've encouraged the staff to run with it. So we've got a really big clinical team who are going to Fountain Gate Shopping Centre and setting up a stall, and they're going to talk to ordinary folk who are there going to do their shopping or taking the kids to, you know, McDonald's or whatever, and trying to just raise awareness, get people to think about the import. It's not just about dying, Stephanie. It's not just about that. It's about, if you think about your death, then it enables you to think about what the important things are in your life and focus on those things, because we all get so distracted by the high pace and the high level of, like, we all work so hard and the weekend comes and we're running around doing stuff. And if you thought about, if I had 3 months to live, would I be doing what I'm doing right now? A lot of people say, you know what, I wouldn't be doing this. I'd be doing something else. So really, Dying to Know Day is about living. It's about getting people to think about what are the important things in their life and how can they invest more time and energy on the stuff that matters rather than getting caught in this treadmill of stuff that doesn't really matter and then getting a diagnosis and going, oh, my God, I didn't do all the stuff I wanted to do. That's what Dying to Know Day is all about.
So let's talk about some of the tools that we can use with making some plans. And I know that you're a big advocate for having a death plan, which really is probably a life plan more than a death plan. Can you explain what a death plan is and what it perhaps should include?
So for me, a death plan is about, if someone said to me, I've got 3 months to live, what would be the things that I really wanted to get done in that 3 months, and where would I want to die, and how would that happen, and who would be there, and what would happen afterwards? So my view about this is not only about the dying bit, it's about the afterwards bit. And people often forget that piece of the puzzle. You know, people think, oh, yeah, I'll tell my eldest child that, you know, I want to be buried, not cremated, and I want to go here and I want to have this sort of funeral. But what they don't understand is that once they die, their body becomes the property of the executor of their will. So if the executor of your will is a lawyer, he can make a decision about what happened. And it may be the total opposite of what you wanted. So if you step back from that point, this is where having the conversations early is so important, because if you have those conversations with the people around you, then it doesn't get to a point where you're dying and, you know, a long-lost family member arrives on the scene and starts making decisions over the top of those who you've invested with your thoughts and your values and all of that. And I've seen that happen so many times, where someone who hasn't been engaged in the network arrives and says, no, we're doing this. and the person who's dying has no say about it. So having the conversations, writing that stuff down, means you have more control over what happens with your dying and then after your death. And look, I'll tell you a really quick and good example is my mother-in-law died in March this year, and she was 84. She was in a nursing home. She was always scared stiff of dying. And before Christmas, I went and spent some time with her and said, listen, Ma, we need to talk about the, you know, your advanced care plan. Let's write some stuff down. Tell me what you want, you know. Anyway, we had this long conversation about how scared she was of dying, and I said, well, ask her what you're scared about. You know, tell me what it is. So I was able to explain to her those things that you know, most ordinary people don't know. So she was scared of dying in pain, and I said, well, that won't happen because I'll be there and I'm telling you won't have any pain. And she was scared of dying in an emergency department and not in the aged care facility and all of that. And then she said, and I really want to have a purple coffin, like a mauve coffin. And I said, fine, we'll sort all of that. Anyway, when she got sick, they sent her in the ambulance to the emergency department. The nursing home rang me at work. I went straight there. She was obviously really rapidly deteriorating. And I just said to the staff, she doesn't want to die here. She wants to die at home, at the nursing home. So I rang the nursing home. We got an ambulance. We got her back there with all the meds and everything else. And she died with my husband and my sister-in-law and me sitting by her bed. She had a beautiful funeral at the Abbotsford Convent, and she had a mauve coffin. So she had everything she wanted, and she wasn't scared. So that's what it's all about. It's about information. If you give people information, you take away the fears that are built into people from ignorance, really. And it's not their fault that they're ignorant. It's because no one talks about this stuff.
And Molly, you know, you've had an extensive background in palliative care. For a lot of people, those sort of conversations are really, really difficult for a lot of family members. I mean, I know myself, I find it very easy to talk about this stuff because I work in the funeral profession. So for me, it's second nature. But for families who find it very difficult to talk about this sort of stuff, is there someone that they can have this conversation with who's not a family member? And ideally, you know, when should they have that conversation?
Look, my view, Stephanie, is that people should be having that conversation all the time. Like, I've had the conversation with my grown-up kids. Every Christmas, you know, we sort of revisit our advanced care plans. And last Christmas, my middle son said, do you know what, Mum, I was just thinking in the last couple of months, I really want my ashes scattered under a Japanese maple. And I said, oh, cool. So I know that now. We all know that now. And that'll happen. And it's not like we spend the whole of Christmas dinner talking about dying, but everyone sort of updates their plans at that time because we're all together. And so it means everyone's on the same page. When should it happen and who should it happen with? I think the conversation should be happening from the time you've got little kids. So when little kids start asking about dying, we need to not avoid the issue. We need to stop what we're doing, sit down and answer their questions. But in order to do that, we need to be informed ourselves. And that means confronting your own challenges and fears around mortality. But the bottom line is, you know, some of us will never have children. Some of us will never get married. Some of us will never get a driver's license. Some of us may never vote. But all of us are going to die, so why aren't we talking about it? You know, I just don't understand the apprehension we all have about it. I do in a way, but like we've got over that in terms of sex education. Like when I was, you know, 17 or 18, people didn't talk about using condoms and safe sex and all of that. But everyone talks about that with their kids now because we know how important it is. You know, you don't give your kid, your 18-year-old, the keys to the car and say, go off and drive without making sure they've had driving lessons and they've done the hours they need to have in their book. You don't throw your child into a river unless they've had swimming lessons. This is exactly the same. We need to be informing our children from the time they're really little that life ends eventually. And kids want to know about it. They ask questions about it. Mm. But the problem is grown-ups either change the subject or they avoid answering the questions honestly, and then the children develop the same sort of angst around death that the parents have because they think it's something secret and scary.
As a palliative care expert, what changes, Molly, have you noticed in our understanding of death, particularly over the last 10 years, as I think that we are becoming better at talking about it?
I think we are. And I think, to me, Stephanie, the important thing is that we demedicalise the whole dying thing. And that doesn't mean you pull apart a really good system of palliative care and open it up to the market, because there is certainly a move the recent Productivity Commission report talks about competition and a user choice and all of that stuff. Well, you know, if you're 2 months off dying and someone says to you, you can choose out of these 5 services, like, you're not in a place to make a choice. And most people haven't even talked about what those choices could be up until that point. So there's that end of the spectrum. And the other end of the spectrum is that local communities are starting to say, you know what, the lady next door to me is not really well. How can I help out? And the compassionate communities movement that really started here with Alan Kelleher from La Trobe University like 18 years ago has grown in the UK and in Canada. And that's all about getting local communities to pull together when someone's really sick. And it doesn't mean you have to go and wipe their bum or wash them in their bed or whatever else, but it means that someone's coordinating the fact that 7 lamb casseroles don't turn up on the same day, and, you know, that the kids are picked up from school and the lawns are mowed and, you know, the person's taken to their doctor's appointment, and that the carer isn't left to do all of that stuff. And for me, that's a really great leap forward.
And what happens, Molly, when an individual's wishes can't be met for, you know, simply for practical reasons? You know, you may have somebody with a terminal illness who is at home and they have got a partner caring for them. The partner might be a female and might be, you know, slight and not well themselves and not physically able to take care of that person. You know, how compromised do you become then when you're not meeting their wishes and they do have to go into a care facility?
And look, Stephanie, that's a really good point because, you know, if you look at all of the research that's been done around unpaid carers and you look at the data that talks about, you know, average age of death in this country, by and large, a lot of people find themselves in the position where they become a carer all of a sudden when previously they've been the person who has had the chronic illness or who has had the disability or whatever else, and their partner's been the person looking after them. So that is really common. And again, I go back to the whole idea of compassionate communities, because if you've got a mobilised community who can do the basic stuff like meals and, you know, looking after the housework and shopping and appointments and stuff, then that means the carer can focus on doing what they're able to do with support of their local community. And it also means that both the carer and the person who's dying don't all of a sudden become alienated from their normal network. But that won't happen until networks start to evolve that are informed and feel more confident about knocking on the door next door and saying, what can I do to help? Because people are scared of doing that because they're frightened of saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing, so they don't do it. And that means the carer is usually left on their own trying to do everything when a lot of the time it's beyond their capability.
Yeah. And look, from my experience, it takes a family, and that family, you know, there has to be three or four other members apart from a partner and members of the family who can help with lifting. I mean, I see that as the biggest problem in these situations is lifting the person to, you know, get them in and out of bed and on and off toilets and in and out of showers. It's, you know, it's not easy caring for someone at home. But so many people want to remain at home, and it's so important to people that they do.
There's two things there. The first thing is that carers a lot of the time aren't taught how to do that in a way that doesn't put pressure on their own body. So my organisation is very focused on training carers up from the get-go. How do you transfer from bed to chair? And how do you do it in a way that protects your own back and all of that? And how do we put equipment in there that you can use that will help you do that? So there's that element. But the other element is to think about the whole concept of home, because a lot of people say, I really want to die at home. But when you explore what home means, it doesn't necessarily mean in their own bed, in their own geographical location. It can mean a whole lot of other stuff. It can mean certain people. It can mean certain rituals being able to happen. It can mean certain food. It can mean certain cultural practices being able to happen. And when you define what home means for someone, then you can actually provide a home-like environment in somewhere that's not their geographical home. And, you know, for Aboriginal clients, you know, the whole idea of going home to country is really, really important. But sometimes you can bring country to them if you're not able to get them back to country. And I think that's a really big lesson for those of us who are Anglo-Celtic, that home or country is a concept, it's not necessarily a place. So we need, as a community, to be having those conversations with the people that we love about what home means to them. And I've got to say to you, sometimes someone will say over and over, I want to die at home, meaning in their geographical home, in their own bed. And 2 days out, they'll go, you know what? I don't want to be here. I want to be in hospice, or I want to go into hospital. I want to be able to press a button and have someone here. And as professional providers of palliative care, we've got to be really receptive to that and ready to kick in and alter the plan. And really, that's the guts of what palliative care is. We have to have a big picture plan, but we also have to be able to change that, you know, with really short notice as people's priorities change. And they do. And they do regularly.
So,
I was just going to say, and it can happen the other way around with someone in hospital or in hospice who goes all of a sudden, you know what? I reckon I'm dying in the next couple of days. I just want to go home and have a beer on the veranda. And I've managed to, well, not me personally, but organisations I've worked in, we've got people home to enable them to do that. And that's a really, you know, that's the joy of the job. You know, if you can get someone home, like I got a man home years ago who lived in a shed by a river an hour out of town, and all he wanted to do was to die sitting on his camp stool by the river. And he'd been in the hospital for 2 months, and we got him home, and he died on his camp stool by the river. And, you know, it just means everybody pulling in together and going, right, what do we need to do? And let's get it done.
So, Molly, what is your most important message to people wanting to face immortality?
Just talk about it. You know, talking about death doesn't make you die quicker. You die when you're going to die. And all of us are going to die one day. So I would go back to what I said to you earlier, Stephanie, about, you know, we talk about sex, we talk about, you know, driving, we do all of this stuff to keep us safe. And this is just another way of keeping us safe, I think, is to have these conversations, to be open about it. No matter how uncomfortable it is, it's reality. And if you can put aside your own apprehensions to listen to someone else's views about what they value and what means, you know, what's the stuff that matters to them, then you're giving them a huge gift, and hopefully you get that gift in return.
Thank you, Molly. Thank you for joining us on Joy 94.9 and for sharing amazing insights into talking about the future, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, who knows, Stephanie? Like, I can't remember if I'm on my first go-around or my 75th go-around, but the bottom line is, when it's my turn, I don't want people shying away from the subject. I want to be able to talk about what I'm thinking and what I'm feeling and, you know, how it is for me right now. And I want to have the people I love being able to manage that, you know, and I hope that I'll be able to manage that for them.
You've been listening to Joy 94.9's Family Matters podcast, your light-hearted look at parenthood and rainbow families, sponsored by Berry Street. Did you know that Berry Street seeks members of our LGBTI communities to become foster carers? Not only do they have a proud tradition of training and embracing LGBTIQ carers, they officially support marriage equality. Learn more now at berrystreet.org.au, a proud Joy sponsor for over 5 years.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.